Hey, and welcome to FutureThinkers.org, a podcast about the evolution of technology, society, and consciousness. I'm Mike Gilliland.
And I'm Yuvia Ivanova. If you're new to the show and you want to get a list of our favorite books, popular episodes, and to join our community, go to FutureThinkers.org/start.
Hey, and welcome back to the show. Our guest in the next two episodes is Chris Beasley, an author, podcaster, AI startup founder, and healing practitioner who created the Love Lock card deck to help people work with their difficult emotions.
This conversation will air in two parts. In this first part, we talk about accessing your repressed emotions in the body and releasing old trauma. What are some of the most helpful techniques and tools for doing it, and how to integrate this type of work into our lives? This conversation is really relevant to the world we live in today, because increased stress and isolation makes it really difficult for us to deal with our emotions in a healthy way. So you can find all the links and show notes for both parts of this conversation at futurethinkers.org/102. And the second part will go live in about a week. Enjoy the interview.
Check out our new course in personal evolution. Part one is on cultivating sovereignty and is designed to support you in developing more clarity about your direction and purpose in life, making better decisions, and having more agency to live your life on your own terms.
Part two is on integrating the shadow and is designed to support you in overcoming nihilism and tapping into an inner source of energy, creativity, and wisdom to make meaningful progress towards actualizing your full potential. To learn more, go to courses.futurethinkers.org. Hey, Chris, welcome to the show, and we're very happy to have you.
Yay, very excited to be here.
Cool. So I think there are a lot of different things that we wanted to cover today. But one of the things that I'd like to start with is a question that we often get from our listeners that I think you have some very interesting answers for. And that's how to access the repressed emotions in the body. Because we talk quite a lot about shadow work, and a lot of that is, you know, kind of body stuff. So what are some of your favorite techniques for doing that?
I think it's unfortunately not the simplest answer, because each body is different. And even though a lot of us are sort of stuck in our heads, we come from very different childhood conditioning. And I like to look at this through the framework of stress response, because we know that stress is something that's increasingly an issue for everybody. Like 95% of the doctor visits are caused by or exacerbated by stress. So that being said, as kids, we all figured out how to deal with the stresses of our culture and our family of origin, but we did it in different ways depending on what our natural innate abilities and talents were. So I look at it through the lens of fight, flight, which people usually have heard of, but there's actually two more, freeze and please. And when the research was initially done on stress responses, it was done just on men, and they missed the please response, which is also called tend and befriend or fawn. It's so new that the terminology hasn't actually coalesced, but I like please because it's about this idea of people pleasing, which if you are a woman and, you know, if you think way back evolutionarily, if you've got a couple of young kids and an abusive father of them, you still need food. You still need, you know, the deer meat that that father perhaps has the ability to provide. So literally, if we're thinking about how do we just continue to exist, how do we not get killed by the saber-toothed tiger, how do we not survive, starve in a famine, the please response makes an enormous amount of sense. So depending on whether you are fight, flight, freeze, or please, you need to come back towards the center. So what's going to work well for someone who has freeze or please is going to be the opposite thing that works for somebody that tends to the fight response. And you can see this in your physical body, in the posture, in the way that we hold our stress. And there's an amazing book that I've just gotten completely obsessed about called The Unemotional Anatomy by Stanley Kellerman. And perhaps we can put some of the images in the show notes or the links to it, because it's just, you see it and you see these stress responses in the people that are walking by you every single day, whether you tend to be more pulled up and the diaphragm is pulled up. That's the posture of contempt versus someone whose shoulders are collapsed forwards and they've sort of liquefied in the middle. That's the posture of defeat. So looking at someone's body, you can almost tell what the thing is that's going to bring them back into greater agency, into greater ability to feel their body. People who probably have the hardest time feeling their body are the people on the freeze and please, because the fight and the flight, they feel a lot. They're very in their body. You can feel yourself when you feel rage, right? It's a very enlivening emotion. It has your heart circulate. You know you're feeling an emotion. But culturally, we tend to really penalize that. So I think we have more people that do end up in that depressed place, that shut down, numb state. Those people are probably going to need to upregulate. So you're looking at doing things like breath work. We were just doing a Bastrika breath before we started recording, which is breathing through your nose, not sucking back in through your mouth. If you're hard out and hard in, that's a bellows breath, and that's also useful. It's a different thing. So Bastrika is just forcefully out through the nose and just letting it automatically return without exerting any extra effort. So it sounds and looks like this. which is funny. Breath work always looks and sounds funny, right? But if you do that for maybe 100 breaths, you'll start to actually tone your diaphragm again, which is part of what has collapsed due to chronic stress. And with breath work, you can start really quickly to come back into your body. It's a natural bridge between the subconscious or the unconscious and the conscious, because generally it is regulated by our autonomic nervous system, but we know it's very easy to consciously choose to breathe. So that's already at that natural intersection, and I think that's the easiest doorway in. There's other techniques like Wim Hof and holotropic breath work that can really bring a lot of stuff to the surface. And I will say that myself, I tend to not feel my emotions so much on the surface as I observe them playing through my body. So sometimes my face will scrunch up during breath work into like a really nasty frown or something, and I don't feel the sadness sort of mentally, but I can see that my body is expressing the sadness. So if you just realize that those two things can be disconnected and watch it play like a movie and go, oh, my body is holding a lot of sadness right now. Even if I feel disconnected from it, just observe it and know that the body itself is experiencing that sadness, and consider that just as real as something that might make you cry.
The please response is really interesting, and I'm glad it's kind of being put on the stage with the rest of the stress responses, because I used to see my mother do that growing up when, you know, dad was angry about something. She would automatically go into this kind of nervous laughter and then try and make a joke or try and like lighten the mood. And I never understood that, because I was always straight into the conflict, like ready to battle. And, you know, neither of those techniques worked every time, but it was kind of interesting to see how the result was different depending on who had reacted first and in what way. You brought up Wim Hof breathing techniques, which is something Yuvi and I have just gotten into just in the last few days. And it's been really interesting to experiment with that the last few days. I was really skeptical with it, and then did it, and I kind of dread it every morning because I get lightheaded and I get kind of headaches, cluster headaches around my head. But after the first round of it, I start to feel great, and then the cold shower comes right after that, and I feel like I really hate the temperature stuff. I hate saunas. I hate ice baths. Really can't stand them. Like, I have to have perfectly temperature controlled environments, otherwise I'm cranky. But doing the Wim Hof method and then jumping in the cold shower is actually completely easy now. And that's been one change. And then another change has been just the energy that's followed in the last week of trying this out. Like, I'm going to the gym. I have way more energy in the gym. I have way more energy for focus, that kind of thing.
Mm. I've also noticed mental clarity improve for me.
Yeah.
Like, I'm just zeroed in on what I have to do after doing this breath work. And I'm like, okay, let's do it. I'm so ready.
Do you know the differences between the different techniques and what they're kind of meant for? Like the one you mentioned, I forget the name of it.
Bastrika.
Yeah. And then there was the other one, the holotropic. I thought that was the same as the Wim Hof method, but is it different?
I'm not an expert in the breath work, but holotropic can be different things. I've seen it facilitated with a double breath in through the diaphragm, really through the stomach, the navel, and then a single breath out, and combined with sound meditation. There's a fun group here in San Francisco that facilitates it that way. I think there's different techniques with holotropic, depending on how in depth you want to get to it. There's, you know, if you were in a place like San Francisco, which obviously most of the world is not, that's the biggest problem with holotropic, is that you need to be in a place with facilitators to go really, really deep in these big group sessions, which are great, but you can do them on your own. You're just not going to go quite as deep, because breathwork is really actually no joke. Something like holotropic, if you stay with it for 30 minutes, your body will really not want you to continue in it. It's difficult, and having a facilitator or being with a group makes it much easier to stay with it longer. And then you can get through some of the cramps that can come up, or the headaches and stuff like that. And it will absolutely release some emotions. You might start crying. You might not even know what you're crying about. And there's serious counterindications for holotropic breathwork. It may be a similar technique to Wim Hof, but they go pretty deep with it. Like, I don't think Wim Hof has you continuing with the breath for an hour, for example.
No,
I think it's about 10 minutes.
It's 15 like for three rounds, basically minutes, 5 minutes per round.
Yeah, but it's in fighting past that fear that comes up as you get close to opening some emotions. There's this natural part of you that's like, you're opening Pandora's box. Is this really what you want to do? Because it's real. It really does open things up, and there are like heart condition issues that you might not want to do it with. It's probably more real than taking a Tylenol or something. So, And if you are by your own assessment, or, you know, a mental health professional's assessment, undergoing any instability, you should not do holotropic breath work.
Yeah. And I've actually like passed out or nearly passed out a couple times from doing breath work. One time I went out, I just woke up, which was probably a bad idea. Like, I woke up and literally went straight to my balcony and sat in this wicker chair and started doing really deep breaths, and then, you know, held my breath. And then I had this rush of, I guess, oxygen or whatever to my head, and I completely lost control of my body. Next thing I know, I am already on the ground, like crawling, because I'm disoriented and I don't know what's going on. I realized later that I scraped the whole like side of my arm, and I didn't feel it completely because I just, yeah, lost consciousness. And I was like, okay, I'm not going to be doing this on my balcony anymore. I'm going to be doing it on a soft couch.
Actually, what happened was you were up too early and I wanted to sleep in longer, so I blow darted you from the bedroom. So that's what that was.
So, yeah, no joke. It's powerful stuff for sure. I wanted to talk to you actually about what to do when the difficult emotions come up, when people access them through various kinds of body work or meditation, mm-hmm. because meditation is often marketed as this kind of, you know, release stress and, you know, be nicer and all of this stuff. But when you do a lot of it, obviously.
I love this line of questioning. And I had a really amazing conversation with one of my former sweethearts who had a massive life change and, you know, like went to Vietnam on a one-way ticket and did meditation. And, you know, I was joking with him. I was like, you wanted bliss and avocados and smoothies, and what you got was, you know, understanding that your body was in chronic pain, which you didn't formally know because you had numbed yourself. And these things are often all bound up together, chronic pain and emotional history of trauma and all that stuff is stored in the body. And it's not for no reason that we numb to these things, right? Healing often needs to get a little bit worse before it gets better. In any of the disconcerting, uncomfortable emotions, really the lesson is that we either can sort of submerge them and keep them right under the surface, and they will be unconsciously driving our lives, but we don't have to quote unquote deal with them. As Brené Brown says, you can do vulnerability or vulnerability will do you. You can do your emotions or your emotions will do you. So that's the reason that we engage with it, is to come into greater agency and also to find joy, which we talked about at the end of the podcast where I interviewed you all. But to answer your question about how to be with it is first to trust that if you can go into the emotion and actually fully feel it, if you feel a 4, make it a 400. Just fully surrender as much as you can to whatever the sensation is that's arising. And know that when you do that, it will change. It will transmute into something else. The discomfort will turn into bliss as you realize that you can release it and that you're free from it. And then you can get excited about, like, instead of being caught in a fear loop of, oh my God, where am I going to live? Oh my God, the Bay Area is too expensive. Oh my God, blah, blah, blah. Once you can sink into the fear and be with the fear, then you can release it. But you can't release it as long as you're keeping it submerged. And you can't get free of it until you go through it.
Yeah, the way, what is it? The way past is through?
Yeah.
Yeah. This actually comes up a lot because it seems that in the modern culture, people don't have very good tools. Like, they're not taught very good tools for how to deal with difficult emotions. And they're taught to suppress them, and like productivity comes first, and everybody has to be happy and cheerful and nice all the time. So it's no wonder that people just keep this stuff repressed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and people literally don't think it's possible. I wrote an article about you know, like understanding what your boundaries actually are. Cause everybody's like, yeah, I'm going to set my boundaries. And then it's like, well, but where is the line? What is the list of things that I am and I'm not okay with? How do I even tell if I'm okay with that? You know, it's totally reasonable to, you know, to expect me to change the sheets on the bed or something, for my partner to ask my help, changing the sheets on the bed. And yeah, it is reasonable. There's a lot of things that people ask us to do that are reasonable, like they are, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily a good idea for you to do that. If somebody asking you to do something as simple as, hey, can you help me change the sheets on the bed? If a knot of anger wells up in your throat and you feel like you have, you know, a dragon fire coming out of your face, then maybe I have no idea why that might happen. You might not even know why that's happening, but to take a breath and be like, yes, that's reasonable. And for whatever reason, my body is just saying a big fat hell no. I'm not a yes to that today. Not right now. Not for whatever reason. Don't even have to understand what the reason is, but starting to use your body as a compass and to trust that there is wisdom in that no. And my other favorite phrase is like, stop shoulding all over yourself. I should. It's reasonable. I should help my partner change the sheets on the bed.
I should the bed. I hate when that happens.
Don't you though? But starting to engage with the body when it gives you such a clear no will help you figure out, because I guarantee you, if your partner asks you to do something that's reasonable and that kind of trigger flares up, there's something. It's not about changing the bed. It's not because you're a horrible person. It's not because you don't want to help your partner. Like, all of that stuff is true. And if you can get past those stories of like, I'm a lazy piece of shit because I don't want to help my partner, then you can actually figure out what the underlying thing is about. But if you just continue to submerge it, you'll never talk about that thing. And then it really, like, the shit will hit the fan at some point later on when it's even more complicated to understand, because it'll be even a bigger thing that's snarlier and the Gordian knot of shit. And if you can pick it apart when it's at a relatively low level, then it makes the task much easier. But when I wrote that article, I get comments. I've turned comments off of almost all of my articles, but I just saw a comment come through yesterday that was like, you just wait till you have a family and you have to do shit. And I'm like, no, it's the same. Your body is still giving you information about your boundaries, and you still can observe your boundaries even when you have a child to take care of. I'm pretty sure that that's okay.
Yeah, one of the things we talked about recently, I think, I don't know if it was on the podcast or in the group calls, I think it might have been in the group calls, that using your body as a barometer, but not literally, but a lot of the time it's the meta. Like, what is that actually saying about your experience? And actually, specifically, we talked about it in the kind of more esoteric sense. We talked about how to use divination or astrology or tarot to understand your own unconscious. And so it's not the information that you're getting, like you get a specific tarot card and you're like, have a reaction like, no way, or like, oh my God. Like, it's not the information that it's presenting you that's the truth. The truth is your reaction. And then to observe, like, okay, why am I reacting this way? Like, what is the pattern that's happening in my head or the emotional association with this that's causing this reaction? And then you can learn a lot about yourself.
Yeah, so. I completely agree. That's the thing that I like most lead into when I'm teaching workshops about, you know, demystifying oracle reading, is just to say these cards are made out of paper. All of the wisdom, all of the power, it's all in you. It's what you bring to it. And a lot of people are skeptical. It comes in two sides. There's people that are skeptical because they're like, these stupid cards, they can't teach me anything. It's like, you're totally right. But they are a tool for you to inspect what arises in yourself. And then there's the other side of people that really, really overbelieve in oracles and think that there's wisdom that's contained in the oracles that isn't in them. And like, this is somehow going to tell the future, or, you know, I don't know. Like, for me, I'm not in a place to draw a card until I can get centered in my own self, in my agency, in my sovereignty, and feel like, ah, this is a tool for me to inspect what's going on. And if I can't feel myself, if I, like, for example, if I sit down to read a card and I'm all frantic, it's a good checkpoint for me to go, oh, right, I am a mess right now. I am spinning. I am dizzy. I haven't drank water. It's just this checkpoint for me to check in with myself and go, what is even happening? Why am I so spun out? I need to go use the bathroom because I can't feel my intuition when I need to pee. I can't. It's too strong of a signal. I can't feel my intuition when I'm too thirsty. I can't feel my intuition when my blood sugar is plummeted. And so I have to go and fix those things. And sometimes I don't even, you know, choose to draw a card. Once I've sorted that stuff out, that was all I wanted in the first place. Am I too cold? Am I too hot? Is anything poking me? Just really take care of the basics.
I've really found that YouTube, maybe it's the YouTube algorithm, I don't know, but headlines and the videos I'm scrolling through seem to be really stupid if I haven't had anything to eat yet. Same thing with Reddit too.
It's like the algorithm like knows, yeah, that you're going to collect on the stupidest stuff.
Collectively, everyone else gets dumber if I haven't eaten.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. I thought you meant like after you clicked a few of them, you realize that it's giving you more stupid stuff because you're in that kind of stupid
reactionary
state.
Actually, that's probably true too. I'm clicking on stuff that makes me angry, so I get more of, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's all the self-reinforcing loops, right? You can either be in a self-reinforcing loop that's helping you climb out, or you can be in the one that's spiraling down, and that's most of what I'm paying attention to throughout the day. Is this thing going to make me spiral down, or is it going to help me spiral up? Because all of the momentum is going to push in whichever direction it's doing. So if you can just build on those things that give you more energy, then you'll have more energy to have more energy. Mm-hmm. It just gets easier and easier.
I just went to the chiropractor today, and I've just had some chronic back pain for about 6 months, maybe more. And suddenly I realized, like, I was feeling my age more. I was feeling older than what I was than my actual age. I was feeling heavy. Like I felt like I'd gained a bunch of weight that I hadn't gained. And suddenly, you know, 15 minutes in the chiropractor, I felt light. I wasn't moody. Like everything was just changed all of a sudden. I had no idea I was carrying so much pain.
Mm. Yeah. There's this really funny tweet actually that I saw a couple days ago. It was, I can't remember the exact wording, but it was something like, oh my God, what is this horrible pit inside of me? I'll never be right again. It's like mind. And then body says, you have to feed me. And then mind says, it's like not listening. It's continuing like, I will never feel okay again. The pit inside of me is increasing. The body is like, just eat anything, literally.
It's interesting, the, you know, we've talked about these sort of, I don't know, I've in the past kind of considered them to be like woo or hippie kind of stuff, like, and I've just kind of rolled my eyes at it, but this divination, the tarot cards, it's interesting hearing it from the perspective of, no, this is not about like predicting the future, this is about how you react to external events and then becoming aware of what your, you know, what your reaction is. That's such a better way to explain that. And I like thinking of it that way in combination with what we've talked about with synchronicity in that, you know, the episode with Kirby Surprise that we did. His explanation of what's going on with synchronicity and then combined with your emotional reaction to things explains so much esoteric stuff that just works but makes no sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's like your pattern matching algorithm is noticing things and then you have an emotional reaction and you assign significance to it so that you look for more of those things and it's a self-reinforcing loop.
Yeah.
Right. And I've created a card deck that is about inspecting the dark emotions and understanding that for every dark emotion, there is a corresponding light emotion. And really, the biggest thing for tarot, why I got into tarot in the first place, and that was what later inspired me to make my own card deck, was I realized that it was a tool for having deep conversations with people and with myself. So if I sit down with someone that I've never met before, I come from the South and it's very polite. And my Depression era grandma was always like, we don't talk about dirty laundry. I have a cousin that's a lesbian and been living with a woman for a decade and nobody in the family has ever, ever, ever talked about her being a lesbian. That's just her friend. We just don't talk about anything in my family. And I hate it. I hate it. I really hate it. And tarot, at some point I realized, oh, I can do tarot readings with people and we will have a conversation that we would never have had otherwise, because, you know, I sit down with somebody and often they're not familiar with tarot and they're like, okay, how do I do this? And I say, well, what's most alive for you in your life right now? What do you feel blocked on? Is there anything that you would like greater clarity on? And they suddenly get real. They suddenly talk about the thing in their life that is the most important to them in a completely different fashion. And they get to set the level of intimacy. You know, are they gonna bring up some traumatic event that happened in their childhood that they don't wanna talk about? No, they're gonna talk about whatever is the deepest and the realest thing for them, but they're not gonna exceed their own boundaries and bring up something that they're really not ready for. So I find that a really great self-leveling. We are gonna get to go deep, but we're not gonna go too deep. And then from there, my card deck, you know, it sometimes even scares me in a funny way when I'm about to turn a card for myself or with somebody else. I'm like, oh God, this card deck is real. It has real cards in there. There's cards about self-righteousness. There's cards about death. There's cards about grief and love.
So take us through what you're actually doing with the cards, with your card deck.
Well, if I'm doing a reading with someone else, I'll do just what I described. What's most alive? What do you need any guidance about? Is there something you need more clarity? And it's important to set a context for reading, because if you just go, oh, I'm going to shuffle the deck and draw a card, then you're not going to have any idea what that card is relevant to. And it's going to be way harder for you to dig into what's really there, right? Because if you turn a card about love, I'm like, well, I love chocolate and I love my new car and I love my dog. And, you know, like that's not really helpful. But if you said, what is going on with this situation with my, you know, my coworker that I'm not getting along with, and you turn the love card, you'd be like, love, why am I turning that in the context of this person? And that would spark a completely different thing. You know, like, what's the relevance of love in this relationship? What do I love about that person? It turns out I love that they're really persistent, and that they speak with clarity, and that they showed up and said the thing that was hard to say. And maybe that's what I'm pissed off about them, but I can see how I love that quality also. So does that make sense thus far?
Yeah.
And then the other rule is to not turn a different card if you don't like the card. Mm-hmm. This is probably my cardinal rule of tarot, is don't turn another card. Because if you turn it over and you get it and you like it, that's really helpful. But often the things that I get the most depth and growth out of are the cards that I turn and go, I don't understand that at all. I don't like this card. It doesn't make any sense in this context. And if you just stay with it, especially if you can journal a little bit about it, by the end of the first page of writing, something will pop out that you couldn't have gotten to any other way. So like 5-10 minutes of writing can get you to a very different place. And that's the whole point of doing it.
Again, it's that idea of leaning into discomfort, right? That's where the biggest opportunity for growth is. It's not in bliss and love and the stuff that you really want to hear. It's the stuff that you really don't want to look at.
Well, it's funny. The name of the card deck is Bliss Oracle. And the opposite of the Bliss card is, it's Clash. It's either Clash or Self-Sabotage. This is kind of the last card that's getting added to the deck. It's kind of the summation, the superposition card of all of the deck. And it is about if you go very much into discomfort, it will transmute into bliss, actually. But the opposite is also true. If you go into bliss a lot, if you really sink into bliss, you will see the little voices that show up and say, you don't get to feel that good. Whatever your story is that tries to pull you back down to your normal sort of emotional homeostatic point, there's a book about this, and they call this the upper limit problem. That we kind of have this habitual level of happiness. You think about it like a thermostat. And if you exceed that level of happiness, if you get too happy, you'll start to self-sabotage and pull yourself back down, because your emotional body does not know how to be that happy and doesn't feel like it's safe to be that happy. So it's a little more complicated. You can pull out some of what your limiting beliefs are by attempting to sink into that bliss, and just seeing, what do the demons say? Is there something like, no, you can't be happy. If you were happy, you'd quit your job, and then you wouldn't have money, and then you would die. Some version of that.
Yeah, for me, it would probably be like, no, you can't have a lot of money, because then you'll get lazy and stop doing anything.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a really common story.
Yeah.
What do you think about training yourself to experience different emotions, to kind of expand your emotional body to be able to handle these more far-reaching states like bliss or no self or anything like that? Like, because it's obviously there's a crash that can happen if you experience something like that and you're not used to it. But if you train yourself to do it on a regular basis, then it gets easier.
I'm not sure I understand which technique. Is there a specific thing that you're thinking of? I mean, definitely the more time you spend with your emotions and cultivate a capacity to be with whatever discomfort or comfort that arises, you know, it's kind of a metacognitive skill. So the more that you experience, the more you can experience. The more negative you experience, the more positive you can experience. When you numb your emotions, you numb both the positive and the negative. But is there a technique that you're thinking of in particular?
I was actually asking you about the techniques that you're familiar with. Because for me, I usually do this through meditation, like altered states, meditation induced.
I think meditation is a great way to do that. I think that meditation works really well for people who tend towards the fight flight. I think the freeze please people, which I count myself a part of, meditation is, there's a funny, there's almost a weird trap for meditation for freeze please people, in that our story is already that if we were just more calm, that it would be okay. If I could just bring more calm to myself, then I could anchor this person and that person over there who's fragile and scary. It's either like people who tend to go into please come from homes that either have a very narcissistic parent who's probably the fight response, or the opposite of that, which is a parent who believes themselves to be fragile. So in my experience, I was raised by a single grandmother on like $88 worth of food stamps and not very much money per month. And she had a heart condition, and my whole life, anytime I would get angry, as a child does, and express any big emotions, she would say, "You have to be good and not fight with me. My doctor says that I might have a stroke and die." And so as a child, I got the message that it was not okay for me to have big emotions around her, because I can kill her. I would die. My caretaker would die just because I, you know, was a shitty teenager and screaming. And you can see how well-intended she was, but also she believed herself to be fragile. And so I internalized that and went into please responses. And so if that's the case and you come from that place, it's really important to examine your belief that someone else is fragile, and that by becoming more compassionate and a better communicator and an even more calm person, and if I just do even more self-work on myself, that I can make this relationship work for me. That's kind of a trap. So I don't do a lot of meditation in my own practice. My own is focused around up-regulating, because my childhood coping mechanism is actually fatigue. So I tend to just want to shut down and go to bed when I'm stressed out. Make the other person happy, say whatever that needs to be said for them to be okay with me, and I just go to bed. So the practices that work best for me are going to dance and getting out and taking long walks and making sure that I'm active enough, and I tend to not eat enough. And then that falls into like, oh, now I haven't eaten. Now my body has an excuse to be tired because it didn't have any calories. And we can't go walking because I have a headache because I didn't eat. So observing whatever your downward spiral looks like and understanding that that really does come from a childhood coping strategy that was about keeping you physically alive. These are not just avoiding stress. They are, your body thinks it will die. So starting to catch your body up that we're not going to die is essential for all of the responses, whether that's fight, flight, freeze, or please. Coming into the safety of your present environment, observing that there's no saber-toothed tiger or romantic partner or anybody who's trying to kill you. Observe that there's food in the refrigerator. Observe that there's enough money to buy more food tomorrow. These are literally the steps that I go through in catching my childhood self up to the reality of the agency that I currently have and in inhabiting a fully adult sovereign self.
What do you think is the role of altered states for discovering and integrating the shadow and some of these repressed parts of ourselves?
I love that you asked that. I think altered states are a place when we can make a big jump in resolving some of the trauma that's physically stored in our body. And this is how I primarily use them. And I access altered states through a variety of different techniques, and they all are sort of different portals to different trauma. And when I release it, it has to be meaningful to the body. And so my body tends to release trauma by shaking. Sometimes I have really weird eye fluttering movements. Sometimes my face makes big emotional, like I was mentioning, the big frowns and like bleh. Just letting the stuff physically pass through your body permanently liberates that was stored there. So I can tell that in the work that I've been doing over the last year, I stand differently, I breathe differently, I walk differently, and you can see it. And you can see if somebody's walking down the street, if you know what you're looking for, you can see that there's, that person is schizophrenic. I can tell by the way that they drag their heels. This person is depressed. I can tell by the way that their body is collapsed over, their shoulders are pulled in. And as you start to physically heal those things, you will come out of those habitual physical patterns in your muscles, in your breath, in your posture.
Do you think that there are specific different kinds of altered states that are more suited to the people who are in those four patterns that you described, the fight, flight, freeze, and please?
Yeah, interesting question.
That's a great question. I don't know. It's been my deep hunch that different modalities will work for the different ones of them, but I'm pretty early in the exploration of this, but I feel like this is where my work is taking me for the next couple of years. As I work with different clients on my intake form, I'm asking them about their pain and about how they're sleeping, and do they have a tendency to be an insomniac or to sleep too much, and then figuring out how that maps to the freeze or please response. My very naive, and I know it's going to be more complicated than this, is that people who are stuck in the fight response are more likely to be an insomniac, and someone who's in freeze or please is more likely to be in fatigue. Obviously, there's going to be more nuance in that, but that's kind of the gist of it. And then it becomes, let's get people to upregulate who are too collapsed, and let's get people who are in fight flight to come back down to ground.
Could kind of relate it to, I think you're going to say the same thing, that some people need tightening, some people need loosening. Was that
yes,
it?
Yeah. I think it was Carl Jung that said that in general, if we had to put people in two camps, they either need tightening or loosening.
Yeah, and then you could probably easily categorize the different kind of, I suppose you're talking about altered states, psychedelics, the different...
Psychedelics or breathing induced or meditation induced or... you know, some other thing.
Right.
Yeah. Like if it helps release that particular type of issue.
Yeah. It would be really interesting to explore this and find out where, like what the best techniques are, depending on what kind of, where on the spectrum you fall.
Yeah. Cause it's interesting. Like when I talk to people about meditation, it really, really works for some people and it does almost nothing for other people. And I was wondering why that is. And this framework that you're describing seems to give me some clues.
Yeah. It's also fight, flight, and freeze, please are on a 2x2 matrix because it's about whether you tend to approach the stimulus or withdraw from the stimulus and then what you do. So someone who is pleasing is approaching the person and attempting to fix or help or caretake. They're going towards the stimulus versus the person who is freezing is withdrawing from the person and becoming more of a hermit. So that approach or withdraw is a part of it that's on the scale. And I don't at all understand how that plays into the modalities yet. I kind of only have one of the axes in my framework mapped to anything at this point, but that's just the point that we're at in the work.
Yeah, that's really interesting. As you're talking, I'm trying to figure out where I lie. And I was going through my head, like different examples of how I've behaved in terms of conflict and it really varies. Like I can't map it anywhere.
I would say you're mostly approach based for most things.
For conflict. Yeah. But then in other times it's like sometimes you can see something unfolding, some conflict where the benefit of solving it is so low that I would rather just walk away. Mm. So it's tough to find out where you would fall.
I think we probably all use some combination of these four approaches, but just at different times and maybe some of them more often than others.
I suppose so. Yeah. Like, cause I can think of elements of the freeze, very little of please. I'm not really trying to please anyone. But yeah, the fight or flight thing, I think it definitely mostly is flight if I think about it, or fight if I think about it.
Yeah. It seems to be probably,
is that more of a, I suppose that's more of a masculine thing, right?
Yeah, I think that they've completely missed the please response because they only studied Ben. Right?
Yeah, right.
And it is very important to note that as you're looking at this, the point is not that, you know, you're always going to do one thing or the other. It's completely correct that in different contexts, you're going to do different things. It's about bringing you into agency and sovereignty in that. So that in a moment of trigger, instead of reflexively going to whatever your response is, you have a point in where you can sit in the middle and evaluate and see that you even have any other options. Because sometimes it's appropriate to approach and engage, and sometimes it's complete, like it's the wisest thing to do to lean into that conflict or to remove yourself from that situation or to go be a hermit and disengage or to, you know, speak and appease whatever the thing is. It's about, do you have the space physiologically to make a choice about how to engage in this situation? Or is that choice completely out of your hands because your unresolved traumas are just running your body? And I mean, I know we've all had the experience where we're in a situation and something flies out of our mouth and there was no point at which you feel like you even made a choice to say that thing.
Yeah.
And that's the difference between, you know, you doing your emotions or your emotions doing you. That's why we unravel this trauma. This is why we come into sovereignty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this very, very deep connection that we also noticed between doing shadow work or unrepressing and coming into sovereignty. It seems that it's not possible to do one without the other.
Yeah.
I completely agree.
Yeah. All right. That was part one of our interview with Chris Beasley. You can find all the links and show notes for this episode at futurethinkers.org/102. In part two, we continue to discuss the role of emotional health in society, gaining sovereignty within our bodies, and the relationship between mainstream science and healing practices. Part two goes out in about a week, so stay tuned.
And if you want to stay up to date with our latest episodes, blog posts, or news from Future Thinkers, join our mailing list at futurethinkers.org/mailing-list. To meet like-minded people, join our Future Thinkers Discord community. Go to futurethinkers.org/discord.
Check out our new course in personal evolution. Part one is on cultivating sovereignty and is designed to support you in developing more clarity about your direction and purpose in life, making better decisions, and having more agency to live your life on your own terms.
Part two is on integrating the shadow and is designed to support you in overcoming nihilism and tapping into your inner source of energy, creativity, and wisdom to make meaningful progress towards actualizing your full potential. To learn more, go to courses.futurethinkers.org. Don't forget to subscribe and hit the bell icon to get notified of new videos. You can also follow us on social media to stay connected. If you'd like to get a t-shirt like the new Make America Think Again, go to futurethinkers.org/store. If you like what we do and you want to help us make more podcasts and videos, consider donating or becoming a patron at futurethinkers.org/support. Also visit our sponsor Qualia and use the coupon code FUTURE to get 10% off your purchase.